recite one more salawat, please, ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي لا يبلغ مدحته القائلون ولا يحصي نعماءه العادون ولا يؤدي حقه المجتحدون الذي لا يدركه بعد الحمم ولا يناله غوص الفطن ثم الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا والشفيع ذنوبنا سيدنا ومولانا أبي القاسم محمد صل على محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين صاحب العصر والزمان خليفة الرحمن إمام الإنس والجان ولعن الله وأعداءهم أجمعين إلى يوم الدين أما بعد فقد قال الله وقوله الحق بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الذين قالوا ربنا الله ثم استقاموا تتنزل عليهم الملائكة ألا يخافوا ألا تخافوا ولا تحزنوا وأبشروا بجنة التي كنتم توعدون صلوات على محمد وعلى محمد Imam Hussein, the embodiment of resistance, has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 7. We are slowly but surely making our way towards the day of Ashura. And with 4 days away, we have now entered those days where our discussion will become a little bit more critical, and the topics chosen the next 4 nights are rather crucial. When we go to prepare for an ashra like this, of this magnitude and this importance, of course, we lay out our lectures accordingly, knowing full well that as beautiful as the crowd looks to me every single night, this crowd I won't see at the day of Ashura. And this window of opportunity that sometimes doesn't even start till tomorrow night is only very small, and we have literally 3 or 4 days to send a message and the right message. And so I ask you, if you're coming here for the first time and you can make it for the next 3 or 4 nights, I ask you to please join us. The messages that we will attempt to deliver with the help of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala are critical and crucial for our development here in the West, inshallah. And of course, at the same time, for the arrival of our Imam, inshallah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Our attempt from day number 1 has been to introduce this topic of resistance, to talk about the concept of maqavimat in Islam, and to present the very simple equation that resistance equals victory in Islam. The more we resist on the outside, the more on the inside, the more we can expect victory from Allah. And we have now broken down this topic from what was once a very large general topic into very specific discussions now. And we ended our first subtopic last night, where we looked at, across the 4th, 5th, and 6th nights, those skill sets or those abilities we need now to instill in us this power of resistance. We talked about emotional intelligence, we talked about impulse control, we talked about identity last night. And we talked about the fact that if you're not able to uphold your Islamic identity here in the West, the path of resistance is an afterthought. And very easily will you become swayed and pulled by the various deviant tools that exist in society, and you won't be able to resist because you don't have a firm grip on your own identity. And part of that, of course, is developing your identity in proper schoolings here in the West, in proper homes, in proper communities. And today we start our second subtopic within the massive topic of resistance. Today and tomorrow we look at two obstacles in the path of resistance. Sometimes to plant flowers in the garden, you have to first remove the weeds. Otherwise, there's no point in doing any sort of plantation. To establish any sort of ability or any sort of skill inside of you, you first have to identify those factors that will stop that progress of that skill. Remove them first and then, of course, begin the process. And today and tomorrow, we'll look at two different aspects. One of them is a lack of certainty, doubt, shak, be it in the deen of Islam, be it in your own abilities, or be it, let's say, for example, in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. How to remove that and the importance of certainty on this path will be tonight's discussion. And tomorrow we look at courage in Islam. We can't be fearful individuals on this path. If there is a lack of courage inside of us, this power of resistance is not possible. Those who have resisted with success are some of the most courageous individuals we have seen. But we have to understand what the Islamic concept of courage is. And that is my commercial for tomorrow, inshallah. Today, we look at certainty and the dangers of a lack of yaqeen. Because sometimes first to understand the beauty of one aspect, you must look at the zid of that aspect, the opposite of that aspect. To understand the beauty of daylight, we look at darkness sometimes. To understand the beauty of health, we examine sickness. To understand the beauty of success, we examine poverty. And sometimes to understand the beauty of the stage of yaqeen in Islam, we look at those who are shakki in Islam, who are doubtful in Islam. Where Islam now has equated the disease of doubt as a sickness inside of our hearts. That's why if you examine the way the Quran initially begins its message from Surah Baqarah, and when it goes to introduce itself as a book, it does not say that I am a book of hidayat, or a book of guidance, or a book of iman, or a book of sincerity. The first thing it says is what? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alif la mim. Thalik al-kitab la rayba fi. Before any talk of anything of qiyamah and iman and salat and this and that, the first thing it establishes, this book is not a book that has any doubt in it whatsoever. Remove that obstacle, and then we go towards what? Hudal lil muttaqeen. Then we talk about guidance of those who are pious. There's no point in talking about piety and guidance and hidayat and iman if this blockage of doubt is inside of us. Surah Baqarah initially talks about what? The groupings of those who are the mu'mineen, those who are the kuffar, and those who are the munafiqeen, right? It then goes into alladhina yu'minuna bil ghaib and all these different qualities that a mu'min should have. But the initial step is, let's remove the doubts. There's no point in me preaching to you as a book of Allah if you don't have certainty in my existence. And this is an ongoing concept in Islam. The base of our iman is what? Tawheed. The verbal base of Tawheed is what? La ilaha illallah. Even that sentence alone mirrors that la rayba fi inside the Quran. First we reject all the ilahs, and then we say illallah. First we remove everything. La ilaha. Every ilah possible, every idol inside of us. And sometimes we think, what? Idols are these things made out of statues or carved out of wood or physical, actual things that we worship. No, sometimes, even in this day and age, we have these internal idols that block us from the illallah process. And sometimes we don't get past the idea of the breaking of those idols before we enter the realm of Tawheed. So really, what Islam is trying to say is, look inside of you. Anything that blocks the progress, let's remove it, and then let's talk about that. You know, sometimes we think that the Prophet of Allah existed in the era of Jahiliyyah. And enough has been discussed for all of you to understand some of the main qualities of individuals who lived in that era of ignorance. they would bury women alive. They saw women as a liability. They would shed each other's blood very easily, go to war for no apparent reason. And they would worship idols. And sometimes the ignorance would reach such an extreme level that they would worship the very idol they created with their own hands. And we think, oh, that's a historical discussion. That's when that zulamat, that dhulm, and that darkness existed. When the Prophet came, of course, he brought his nur, and he established Islam in that era of ignorance. And we leave it as a historical discussion. It can be argued that that very same environment exists today. Now, we do have disrespect of women. We do have common bloodshed for no apparent reason. And we do have idol worshiping. And yes, the idols have changed, but the worshiping has not. And part of the idols that sometimes you and I have to identify as roadblocks on our path is the idol of doubt. Because when you look and examine the level of yaqeen, it's a level that is absolutely beautiful. The ulama of akhlaq have identified that the body goes through 6 different states. This physical body of ours. Either the body is asleep or it's awake. Either the body is healthy or it's sick. Either the body is alive or it's not. There's no 7th state, I don't think, amongst these 6. When you talk about the soul equally has these 6 different stages as well. When you talk about that soul that is alive, you talk about a soul with ilm and awareness and ma'arifat. You talk about a soul that is dead, you talk about jahl and ignorance. You talk about a soul that is asleep, you talk about ghaflat and heedlessness. You talk about a soul that is awake, you talk about the dhikr of Allah. You talk about a soul that is, you with me? You talk about the soul that is at that level of being sick. You talk about doubts. When you talk about a sahih and salim soul, you talk about a soul of yaqeen. And the Quran is very clear in saying, look, you have lived your entire life serving your children and serving your wealth. And all of that will be of absolute no benefit. يَوْمَ لَا يَنْفَعُ مَالٌ وَلَا بَنُونَ إِلَّا مَنْ أَتَى اللَّهَ بِقَلْبٍ سَلِيمٍ. This sahih and salim qalb that the Quran talks about, that on the day will nothing will benefit you. Not your children, not your wealth. Except for those who will run towards Allah, present Allah with what? Aqalbi Salim. And this whole philosophy, there have been books written on it, there's been discussions written on it. One of the very important ingredients of a sahih and salim qalb is a qalb of yaqeen, of certainty. And that certainty is very, very important. Because we've mentioned discussions about some of the more important companions like Abdullah ibn Abbas and others, and there are several other examples where if the base that you're building on is shaky, and right now all of us are building on this base of iman, we're building on it, if that base is shaky, you could get to the highest floor and the building will collapse because the base is shaky. Let's come to history a little bit. Let's examine the power, the negative power of doubt. If you don't have the proper base of yaqeen, you could get to the point where you are days away, minutes away, seconds away from earning the pleasure of Allah, and your building collapses. The entire historical formation of the Khawarij movement is in front of us. And all of you, mashallah, I know some of you have done plenty of research on the Khawarij movement. I don't want to spend too much time today, but we should know that these are individuals, most of them who were present on Ghadir, gave bay'ah to Imam Ali, sat there and, you know, watched the Holy Prophet announce his wilayat, understood that, yes, this is not an announcement of friendship, but rather of successorship. And the individuals who were so easily swayed by Muawiyah, that when they saw what was supposed to be a Quran on spears, they turned their back on Amir al-Mu'mineen. And these were people who were in the trenches with Ali, in the middle of a war with Ali, who have now allowed their precious life to be in the hands of Amir al-Mu'mineen as a commander of this army. And the moment Muawiyah, sensing defeat, does this tactic with the Quran on spears, they turn around and question Ali, are we fighting you or are we fighting the Quran? And Imam Ali is begging them, please understand, those are leaflets, pieces of paper. They're nothing. If you want to understand the true Quran, ana Quranu natiq. I'm in this walking and talking Quran. You don't understand me yet? You don't have certainty yet? You don't have yaqeen yet in my path? Now you're questioning me? To the point where Imam Ali summons Malakesh to come back. He says, Mola, give me 5 minutes. This war is over. Muawiyah is defeated. He says, Malik, in 5 minutes, your Mola won't be here. They've surrounded me. And 20,000 individuals who couldn't figure out what side they were on, their building, 5 minutes left, their building collapsed. And it collapsed so hard, the Qatil of Amir al-Mu'mineen is a member of the Khawarij movement. These were people who were mawjood and ghadir. 4-hour khutbah, burning hot sand, man kunta mawla. They sat there, nadas, hand in hand, bayat, ya, labbaik ya Ali, all of that. Right? That's a strong base. They had doubt. When you study a little bit of history of the Imams, you'll know that we have different sects out there that have kind of, you know, branched off from various imams. There are groups that believe up until the third imam, the fifth imam, the sixth imam, the seventh imam. There's a group called the Waqifi movement. The Waqifi movement are individuals who did waqf, who stopped at Imam Kadhim alayhi salatu wasalam, believing that he was Imam Zamana. Why? Because our eighth imam, Imam Radha alayhi salam, didn't have our ninth imam until very late in his life. And this era and this door of young imams began with our ninth imam all the way until our last imam. And so they thought to themselves, wait a second now, you're 47, you're 48. How can it be that you don't have offspring yet? This lineage of imamah should be carried forward through your son. You have no son to carry this lineage forward. Therefore, you must not be an imam, na'udhu billah. Therefore, the imam that we believe in must be the final imam that we've been hearing about since the first imam. And the leader of this movement, of this Waqifi movement, was a member of the treasury of Imam Qadhim's government. Not some ghair, not some munafiq, not some kafir, not some outsider. Individual who worked day in and day out with our seventh imam. Consulted with him, spoke with him, met with him, all these different things, and he was the man who was responsible of this deviation. Scary? Scary. These are all individuals who have their Imam Hadir in front of them. We don't have the honor of having our Imam Hadir in front of us. I told you about individuals where when this mission of Imam Hussein began, he would go around the streets of Medina looking for people to follow them. It got to the point where the books say that they would actually avoid Imam Hussein, cross the street when he was coming towards them, look down, avoid eye contact, out of fear that he might ask me to come and join him, and I can't do it. He would ask people, have you heard about what's happening in Kufa? You know that I'm going? He says, yes, I know you're going, Imam. Will you join me? Imam, you know, I have a lot of debt on my shoulders. I'm older, I'm no good to you. I can barely fight. I'll pray for you, I'll cry for you, I'll hope the best for you. I can't join you. And then he says, if my cry for help reaches you from Karbala and you don't answer me, you are amongst those who are responsible for the dhulm against me. Then there are those who would sit there and negotiate with Imam and say, Imam, fine, Imam, I'll come with you to Karbala. If you're that adamant about coming to Karbala, and I made this point before, and if you are new in this audience, I'll make this point again for you, that Imam Hussein didn't approach these individuals because he needed help, God forbid. This was the same Imam who begged his companions to go. He wasn't searching for one or two people to come and please help me spare my life. Of course not. He was giving them an opportunity to earn the pleasure of Allah. And there were people who, like I said, joined Imam Hussein all the way up until arrival in Karbala. But with conditions and negotiating with the Imam of your time and saying, I'll join you in your mission to please Allah. But the moment that I think things are going to be a little bit rocky and that defeat will come upon me, then with your permission, I'd like to leave. And Imam Hussein says, sure, no problem. No problem, go ahead. So we actually have a waqiyah of an individual on the 8th of Muharram coming to Imam Hussein and saying, look, Imam, thousands I see gathering on that side. I don't see much happening here. If it's okay with you, I will take and cash in on our deal and leave. He says, no problem, but I don't have a horse for you to go back. He goes, don't worry. As a precaution, I kept my horse stashed away down the road a little bit under a tent just in case something might happen. I have my own way home, thank you very much. And he left. The companions that we revere and respect are those who stuck around until Shabbat Ashur and gave their life on the day of Ashura. Otherwise, there were those who accompanied Imam Hussein. I mentioned this a few nights ago. Can you imagine now accompanying, being a hamsafar of Imam Hussein? Many of you have traveled together in Hajj and Ziyarat as groups. I'm sure you've learned about things of each other that have either added respect or removed respect. I'm sure you've seen sides of people that you loved just yesterday, and now after Hajj, look, brother, we had our Hajj, that's great, but you go your way, and I'll go my way. Because that's what travel does. Travel shows you a side of an individual that normally you wouldn't see. Imagine traveling such a long journey with Aba Abdullah from 28th of Rajab to the 2nd of Muharram. And still not being sold and not having yaqeen on his mission. And he was 2 days away from being included in the shuhada of the day of Ashura. And you and I know what maqam that holds. Why? His base was weak. There are many of us in this room and in this building who have a lot of doubts. And sometimes the doubt starts from the very first root of Islam. We don't understand the existence of God. And sometimes we let that doubt fester and we kind of go through the motions. And unless and until those doubts are actually answered, they'll eventually pull you off the path of Islam. So before we understand the beauty of yaqeen, understand the power of doubts. And once you have the power of doubt that's overtaking now, you become shaky. You become, like I always say, a flag as opposed to a mountain. A flag blows where the wind takes it, right? The flag goes, the wind goes left, the flag goes left. The wind goes right, the flag goes right. The flag has no movement by itself. It's taken wherever the wind wants to take it. A mountain stays where it is. Doesn't matter how windy the air is. Doesn't matter. It could be blowing the leaves and the flag and everything around it here and there, the mountain stays where it is. With doubt, you become a flag. With yaqeen, you become the mountain. And in this era, in this society, out there on those streets, you and I need to become mountains, I'm telling you right now. Too many flags have come and gone. Part of that is for you to now search deep inside of you and begin now one-to-one and actually addressing your doubts. And that means to open doors as leaders of the community, as scholars, as ulama. All of us need to create an approachability when it comes to our youth. There are youth out there who go through their 20s and 30s and still are not able to quite prove to themselves why Allah is one and not two. still not able to prove the fact that there will be a day of judgment. And they need to be addressed. Without it, like I said, the base becomes shaky. And one thing the Ahlul Bayt time and time again did was that an open door policy. Because let me say one thing to you here while we're here. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Any religion, any school of thought within that religion, please follow me very carefully, that doesn't welcome the challenging of its beliefs, that doesn't open the door for these young, bright minds to challenge the very tenets of that deen, any religion that shoos away this very inquisitive generation of ours, is a religion or a school of thought that's not deep in its own certainty. When sometimes you approach non-Shias inside the Islamic world, and you, let's say, debate with them, let's say it's a friend of yours from school, you talk about certain things that are different from Shias and non-Shias, let's say, for example. And the debate gets to the point where, you know, finally you say, look, why don't you go ask your imam? I'll go ask my imam. We'll come back and see what they say. And when you meet up again and you present what your alim said, let's say, and then he says, oh, my alim told me not to be your friend anymore. That's not an answer. When we have individuals that approach sometimes priests and rabbis, and they ask about the Trinity, let's say, they ask about, you know, the oneness of Allah. And they're told, look, brother, don't worry about these details. Just believe. Jesus loves you. Just believe. And you'll be fine. He goes, I believe, but I want to know what I'm believing in. And when it gets to the point where the frustration of the youth now is set in, then they'll stop believing in the path. The one thing the Ahlul Bayt had established from day number one was challenge us. Question us. Don't accept things at face value. The era of our fifth and sixth imams, an open door policy, not just for the Shias and the chosen companions, for everyone, from Christians to Jews to atheists to non-Shias. Everybody came to the door of Imam Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam. And asked them whatever they could. They would challenge the very basis of Allah. We have stories of 90-year-olds, 94-year-olds knocking on the door of our sixth imam and saying, please, I have learned nothing up until now in my life. I want to start over. 94 years old. 94 years old. We don't have anywhere that Imam Sadiq says, look, 94 years old. If I were you, I'd prepare for my next journey right now. Go home and start doing some istighfar. Don't waste my time. Absolutely. I took him in and taught him everything he knew. The point I'm trying to make is that not only is it our job on this side to make it approachable for the youth to now address their doubts, but the onus is upon the youth to go out and address your doubts. And in this era where, mashallah, everything is at the fingertips and there's instant gratification now going on, there's no excuse now. Everything is available. You can, you know, you can text an alim, you can email an alim, you can WhatsApp an alim, you can tweet an alim, you can like an alim. You can stop him in Walmart, anything you want to do. There's no distance now between the alim and you. You ask your parents' generation, they couldn't say boo to the alim. Whatever the alim said, you accept. How dare you ask the alim? That's a different generation for a different reason. I'm not mocking that generation. I'm saying that doesn't exist today. It doesn't anymore. You can sit down and say, look, I want to go to Timmy's until 3 a.m. Let's talk about God. Let's talk about God. You keep feeding me donuts and coffee, I'll keep talking about Allah. No problem. No problem. You keep refilling that cup, I'll keep refilling you. It's okay. Everything is all right. But the onus is on you. No more is it that the fact that at the age of 35 now, you still don't have that lizzat of tawheed. Because doubt is scary. It destroys buildings. It destroys those individuals who walked and talked with the imams. We don't have that luxury. Our onus is something else. Understand the beauty of certainty by understanding the power of doubt. And yes, sometimes the biggest battle is with you and your own ego. And sometimes is, you know what? It doesn't matter. If he thinks I should know this, it doesn't matter. We've had individuals come to us at the age of 65, 70 and say, I don't know how to read Arabic. Come and teach me how to read Arabic. So we go, Alif, Ba, Ta, Tha, the 65-year-old. I have more respect for that 65-year-old than anybody else. Swallow your pride, kill your ego, and come knocking on the door of any alim that you think is worthy enough and begin the process of addressing your doubt and build the beauty of yaqeen. With certainty comes resistance. Now that you're certain on your path, anybody can try to come and pull you off the path and you have this repulsive or this repelling force around you that simply will allow that to bounce off of you and keep going forward. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So how do you build yaqeen? Understand the power of doubt? Let's move to how to build yaqeen. Very, very quickly. I don't have much time. How do you build yaqeen? Too quickly, if I get to the second one, that's fine. If not, the first one is very, very important. The actual way you build yaqeen, and this sounds odd to all of you, is to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I can't tell you enough. You'll think, oh, wait a second, I don't even have certainty in the actual creator, now you want me to worship him. Yes, that's what I'm saying to you. The Quran is saying that. The Ahadith is saying that. And I'm sure there are examples of all of you in this room who also have experienced the fact that when there's a lull in your certainty, to actually, you know, remove that lull, you increase your worship. And in Surah Hijr, the last two ayats, yaqeen is a very beautiful topic discussed at least 28 different times in the Quran. The word yaqeen itself arrives 28 times in the Quran. And one of those times is in these two last ayats of Surah Hijr. The Quran says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sabbiha bihamdi rabbika wa kum min al-sajideen. Celebrate the praise of your Lord and become one of those who are the sajideen. Wa'abudu rabbika hatta ya'tiyaka al-yaqeen. And worship your Lord, worship your Lord, worship Him to the point where yaqeen is now brought to you. Ya'tiyaka al-yaqeen. Not that you actually gain yaqeen. No, yaqeen is now brought to you. Wa'budu rabbika. Worship hatta, until that point where now the doors of certainty are open. And sometimes you and I have it a little bit flipped. Prove to me why I'm doing it, then I'll worship. And the Quran says, no, worship, and in that worship is your certainty. Sometimes you can read all the books you want about the beauty of worshiping Allah. Sometimes you can read all about the beauty of sujood and ruku and salat and ibadat, but until you actually taste and have that dhawq and taste the lizzat that you have when at 3 o'clock in the morning the entire world is asleep, it's you and the moon, and you're in sajda saying Subhana Rabbil Ala wa bihamdi. That ilm, that yaqeen, I'm sorry, sometimes can't be found in the books. It can be found in your worship. Because the kamal of ilm is yaqeen, not the other way around. The perfection of knowledge is yaqeen. Because sometimes ilm becomes a hijab for you. Let me explain it to you and move forward. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. There are individuals who believe that the more I increase my ilm, the more I'm able to get to the level of yaqeen. And maybe that's possible. If that is packaged with amal and ibadat, then yes. If it's ilm standalone, sometimes ilm is a hijab for you, is a veil for you, is a block for you. Sounds odd? Let me give you a few examples. Rumi has a very nice depiction of the story of Nabi Nuh in his Mathnawi. Sometimes, you know, we're on this path of ilm, and while it should be leading us towards Allah, sometimes that ilm leads us towards shaitan. He says that, and I'm summarizing this depiction. He says when the adab came towards the qawm of Nabi Nuh, the people of Nuh, naturally Nuh was concerned about his son. And the Quran talks about the fact that Nuh says, Ya Allah, this is my ahl, this is my family, this is my son. Is he not part of my salvation? Not part of my boat? You not get on? God says, yeah, what? Ya Nuhu laysa min ahlik. He's not from your ahl. Innahu amalu ghayru salih. He is an amal, a deed, that's ghayru, that's not pure. Doesn't belong with you on the path, I'm sorry. He might be your son, but he's not part of your ahl. So Rumi says that when the adab hit, Nabi Nuh was searching for his son and found his son at the top of a mountain. And he's calling his son to come and follow me. This adab won't spare anybody. And Rumi says that's the response that the son gave Nabi Nuh was, Father, don't be concerned. I know how to swim. And then Rumi writes a very beautiful line. If only the son of Nabi Nuh didn't know how to swim. Digest that for a while. Meaning their ilm of knowing how to swim veiled him to understand this wasn't my father that was only trying to protect me from some rain. This was the Prophet of Allah protecting me from the adab of Allah. Sometimes ilm becomes a veil. Al-ilmu al-hijab al-akbar sometimes in the world of akhlaq says. It's a great veil. Because while it might be a dot inside of us, our ego kicks in and we expand that dot to an ocean. And we start questioning sometimes individuals who have spent their entire life swimming in this ocean. Unless that ilm is accompanied with amal and ibadat, وَعْبُدُ رَبِّكَ حَتَّى يَأْتِيَكَ الْيَقِينَ, then that ilm could be a veil for you. If it's accompanied with the right practice, you then end up beginning the process of certainty. And certainty becomes, like I said, one of the foundation pieces of resistance. There is no way Imam Hussein does what he does on the day of Ashura without yaqeen. There's no way that all of his companions do what they do without yaqeen. Either in the yaqeen of Hussein or yaqeen having or Hussein having the yaqeen in Allah. It doesn't matter. Yaqeen is there for sure. There's no way that Palestine continues to stand up against Zionism without yaqeen in their path. Yaqeen is essential. And a lot of times we don't have that certainty. We don't know how to tackle certain issues that exist today. We don't know how to explain to non-Muslims who are coming at us with their own certainty that we're wrong. And instead of us repelling that, they actually shake our foundation. And they cause us to go back and question a principle that should be solid inside of us from day number one. Number one is ilm. Understanding and having awareness of the fact that increasing your knowledge and packaging it with amal. Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, in a very famous tradition, he says, Al-Islam huwa al-Taslim, wal-Taslim huwa al-Yaqeen. Islam is first submission. That submission is certainty. Meaning first submit and certainty will begin to open up for you. Now you're questioning me that how can I submit without certainty? This submission is assuming that you've already, now of course, established the base of Allah inside of you. If that base of Allah is not strong inside of us right now, please, that's your number one job. I'm assigning homework, work on that base first. Everything else builds on top of that. We should be at a point we can debate atheists now on Allah. Are we there yet? Because this ugliness of doubt sometimes can make us very weak. And when we're weak, of course, we won't resist. The second factor, very quickly, and then towards Masaib, is something called Zuhud. And I know that Sheikh Jafar, mashallah, has talked about Zuhud in a very beautiful way on this member in this center. But just very, very quickly, the idea of not attaching yourself to this dunya. A person who's a zahid or a zahida is somebody who, of course, practices zuhud. So the basis of zuhud is a very simple one. That I've said this before many times, Islam has no problems with you acquiring success in this dunya. In fact, I would say that we need successful young Shia youth out there in the workforce. We need Shia doctors, we need Shia nurses, we need Shia lawyers, we need Shia professionals, we need Shia entrepreneurs. And that requires you, of course, to work hard in your studies and work hard in school and focus on your education. With that, of course, comes a very comfortable life, a nice salary, a package of benefits. Islam has no problem with that. Sometimes we equate poverty to iman. Right? The more ripped our clothing is, the more clunker of a car we drive, the smaller our home is, the more taqwa we have. And the richer you are, the further you are from the path. This misconception, I'm sorry, is wrong. Islam says if you've worked hard the halal way, you've earned your risk the halal way, and that's a whole different discussion altogether. That includes, of course, choosing the right profession. That includes paying your khums. That includes halal and haram earnings. That includes all these things. It's not that easy that in this day and age to make a halal income. Imam Saleh says, "Kal mujahid fi sabilillah." It's as difficult as a mujahid on the path of Allah, fighting on the path of Allah. That's how difficult it is. Because sometimes in this day and age, you can't make money unless you lie, cheat, and steal, and rip off your customers, or lie about things on your resume, or fudge a few numbers in your interview. But if you do it all the right way, and mashallah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has gifted you with a nice salary, enjoy it to a certain limit. Where Islam says to draw the line is not the acquiring of that wealth, it's the attachment to that wealth. It's placing a value on those assets that you have that's higher than the actual value itself. Well, now we've seen families fall apart over the estate of their marhum father. We've seen divorces and families crumbled over the fact that a husband and wife fight over the value of a house, let's say, for example. These are all things where now that asset that you worked hard to is now you're placing a higher value on that asset than you should. Now all of a sudden, your father's assets, a few thousands, a few millions, is now worth more to you than silir rahim of your siblings. That's not zuhud. Islam has a problem with that. And if we don't have that concept of zuhud, then we can't expect to have the idea of resistance. Because then we become part of those individuals who are what? Who are in that category of hubbul dunya. And love of this dunya has destroyed those before us, will destroy us if we let it, and destroy us and destroy those after us as well. And we've seen it. We've seen individuals get a little bit successful, and now their chest is a little bit out. They're walking 2 inches off the ground. They have no time for you anymore. Their name changes, their face changes, they trim their beard until you have to sit there and look at their face. So yeah, it's there somewhere. They say, look, I didn't shave today. Okay. A little bit of success. That's not zuhud. Zuhud is the idea of what? Of understanding that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has blessed you with this and keeping it at the value that it should. Not allowing this dunya to consume you. Imam Radha alayhi salatu wasalam. He says this dunya is a bridge. And you don't build homes on bridges. One more time. This dunya is a bridge. You don't build homes on bridges. You ever seen a home on a bridge before? It's foolishness. Why? There's no base there. it's bound to collapse. The bridge is used to transport you from one area to another. It has its ahmiyat and value, no doubt. If you come to a cliff and the bridge is out, then you're stuck. But the bridge is made to what? Get you to where you need to be. It's not the destination, it's the path to the destination. And the problem lies sometimes when our youth have these misconceptions that poverty equals iman, because sometimes all they hear from this world or from this member is what? That Imam Ali gave talaq to the dunya. Imam Ali says the snot of an animal is worth more to me than this dunya. Imam Ali says the laces I use to tie the shoes, to tie my shoes are worth more to me than the dunya. And all these are sahih, absolutely correct traditions. But the same Ali also praised the dunya in Nahj al-Balagha as well. He said, this is the dunya where angels descend. This is the dunya where you worship Allah. This is the dunya where you gain the pleasure of Allah and earn your profit for the next world. Without this dunya, you're stuck. Without the bridge, you can't cross. But those people who have understood this dunya to be the maqsad and the purpose, they have faltered and failed. And the more you're able to understand that I am here for a short time, and I gather what I want to gather, and if there's luxury that Allah has blessed me, I enjoy that, and I move forward, the faster you'll be able to build yaqeen and build resistance. Because now all of a sudden, individuals now who have placed a value on their assets higher than it should be, and when the path of resistance is saying, look, leave those alone, I need you to come with me, it won't be that simple. Very, very difficult. I worked my entire life to get to this income bracket. I worked my entire life to get these assets. And now you're asking me to sacrifice that for Islam, for the movement, for the cause, for the imam? I can't do it. If you're going to place a value on anything in this dunya, it better be higher than Jannah, Imam Ali says. Why? Because that's what you're giving up. Is there anything in this world higher than Jannah? So ilm and zuhd, knowledge and detachment from this world. This requires a whole different ashra altogether. But the important part is that Islam promotes success. We promote success. I would love nothing more than 20, 30, 40 years from now, these kids are MDs and lawyers and accountants and business professionals and running the world, because that's what the imam needs. But at the same time, have enough iman to understand that everything I have from Allah. If Allah wants it back, here you go, Allah. It's not worth anything else. This is not my value. I don't allow my assets to define me. I allow my creator to define me. It's very, very important. I ask those youth out there who are thriving businessmen, may Allah bless you and keep you on this path and make you successful, but do it within the Sharia. That requires you to understand the Sharia and ask questions and not take things into your own hands. Because sometimes what ends up happening is that we believe that this has to be okay and we continue that path. So just to wrap up, to understand what's going on, to build certainty, we need to first increase our knowledge. That requires you to actually read a few books and understand a few concepts and increase your knowledge, and don't rely on what you've heard when you're 15, 16 years old in Sunday school to carry you throughout the year. And second is zuhud. Imam Ali was asked that, why is there a delay in my dua sometimes? He says, because Allah knows that if you are granted what you're asking for, you'll leave the path of Islam. And you don't know that, I know that. Allah knows that if I take a little bit of your salary away from you, let's say for example, then you'll leave the path. If I give you a little bit more, you might leave the path. I'm not saying everybody, I'm saying certain people. And the important part is that these are concepts that come with certainty. And certainty breeds resistance. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So I humbly request my youth out there and my elders, my respective elders out there, identify your doubts in Islam and go to get them answered. There's an answer for everything in the deen. And if you start this path, Allah has guaranteed you that He will help you on the path. وَمَنْ يَتَّقِ اللَّهِ يَجْعَلْ لَهُ مَخْرَجًا. The one who has this piety, this God awarenessness, Allah will create openings for him. Just start the process. Don't allow those doubts to fester. Don't allow those doubts to be ignored. They'll soon pull you off the path. Because when you reach a level of certainty, you reach a level when you're asked, how do you see death? You say that I see death sweeter than honey. That's the level that you get to. You could be a 10 and 11 year old Janab Qasim. When you're asked to understand death, you say there's nothing sweeter than death to me. Because that certainty at a very young age, Imam Hussein's mission was beautiful. Why? Because not only did he have that certainty, he exported that certainty out to everybody, from small children to women to his companions. And then when you are at that level of certainty, giving your life for that cause is nothing to you. Not giving your life for the cause is bothersome for you. You've heard these conversations that these young children have with Imam Hussein. They're not normal conversations that kids have with Imam Hussein in that environment, where they're seeing an army of enemies being formed in front of them, knowing full well that they're there to what? Attack us. And yet on Shabi Ashur, they say that when Imam Hussein was busying himself with worship, his nephew Qasim comes and sits beside him. Doesn't say a single word. And Imam Hussein senses that somebody is beside him. He looks to Qasim. And Qasim says, Chacha, tomorrow is the day of Ashura. And I know you have a long list of those who will sacrifice their life tomorrow. Chacha, am I on that list as well? Imam Hussein doesn't say a single word. What response would you give your 10-year-old nephew? Qasim again asks, Chacha, am I on that list or not? A third time when he asked Imam Hussein turns to Qasim. He says, Qasim, you being on the list is one thing. My six-month-old Ali Asghar is on that list as well. Janab Qasim waits on the day of Ashura. The adhan of Ali Akbar goes. He watches one by one go towards the Maidan and give their life. And with this anxiousness, he looks to look at his uncle's face. When will he call me? When will he call me? When you have yaqeen, when you have that certainty, you don't want that delay. When finally he gets impatient, he says, Chacha, is it time now for me to go and give my life? I talked about the mothers yesterday. Imam Hussein, they say, hugged Qasim for a very long time. You are the nishani of my brother Hassan. When I look at you, I'm reminded of my brother Hassan. How do you expect me now to sacrifice you? When I want to remember Hassan, I look towards you. Janab Qasim says, no, Chacha, you promise I'm on the list. Imam Hussein puts a green imama on Janab Qasim. They say the shoes that he was wearing were so big for him, they had to be tied to his feet. The sword that he had was so heavy he could barely lift it. The armor that he had was too big, they had to tie it. But still, when you have certainty, there's no delay. Jan Abi Qasim gets on the horse and makes his way towards the Maidan of Karbala. He begins to fight in any way possible. And these mal'oon begin to surround the Qasim. When one individual, Umar ibn Sa'd al-Azdi, comes forward and says, I want to kill the boy. And he comes and he begins to attack Jan Abi Qasim. At that moment, Jan Abi Qasim calls out, As-salamu alayka, ya ammata, O uncle, come adrikni, come and help me. When Imam Hussein, Abu Fazl Abbas, begin to enter the Maidan of Karbala, they came with such rage, the enemies thought that Hussein came to fight. So the horses on this side went over here. The horses on this side came over here. The Khak of Karbala was in the air. Imam Hussein is screaming, Aina Qasim, I don't see you Qasim. Where are you Qasim? The sword and the left end of Karbala is in the air. When finally the dust settles, they're lying lifeless on the ground. Is Jan Abi Qasim. Imam Hussein grabs his abba, picks up Jan Abi Qasim, takes him back to the khaymah, says, Zainab, the Nishani of Hassan has given his life. Come and give me purse. سَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ مَاتِمِ حُسَيْنَ